Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. We provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, you can email them to david.lundgren@hancockhorizon.com, and he'll take them at the end of the call. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Officer John Portwood and Investment Directors David Lundgren, Jeffrey Tangus, and Greg Hudleski. And with that, I'll pass it on to David Lundgren, who will serve as the moderator.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this month's Market and Economic Update call. And, John, we'll start with you. And this month, no shortage of topics. It was quite an interesting month on many fronts. And unfortunately, I guess we'll start with Greece. We talked at length about Greece last month. And it looks like there's been a reprieve. They have reached the settlement with their creditors. That looks like it, could extend up to 3 years. But, read some news items yesterday that maybe we're not out of the woods yet. Grexit is not, necessarily off the table. It looks like their economy is really struggling as a result of all of the upheaval caused, towards the end of June, as there was a lot of uncertainty and bank closures, and it still seems a mess, John. Bring us up to date on where we are and where we're heading from here.
Hey, well, you're right, Dave. It seems like a never-ending story, and I guess it will continue for some time to come. However, it does appear that Greece has probably passed the point of no return. The banks have been largely emptied of funds over the last few years. People are still trying to get money out of Greece if they can. Whoever is head of the banks in Greece the other day asked if everyone would help the country by bringing the money back. Well, good luck with that. Nobody's going to bring their money back to Greece and risk a bail-in of the type that happened in Cyprus 3 or 4 years ago, in which depositors, lost some of their assets as the Eurozone agreed to, stabilize the situation in Cyprus. So it almost looks like they're beyond the point of no return. I've forgotten what the statistics are relative to the economic situation, but the collapse in GDP, I think, is on the order of 50 or 60%. In recent months, and people have suggested that the Greek economy has become a barter economy where people are exchanging services, rather than money at this point. So things may have progressed to the point where there really is no turning back, and something rather significant has got to be done at some point, like Grexit, which, wouldn't be too easy on the Greek people either. But the current situation imposes even greater austerity on Greek society compared to what it was enduring before. For example, the value-added tax on many goods is going up from 13% to 23%, and a lot of that would be on stuff that, tourists buy and services they use while they're in Greece, and that's not good for Greek tourism, which is something like 20% of their economy. The rest of it's only, shipping and olive oil. They really don't have much else. So it's really a serious situation. The best thing, of course, in a long-term sense, would be to eliminate all the debt and start over. There's something like $350 billion of debt that's basically no good and will never be paid back. But in this, tortured process of agreeing to keep Greece, or letting Greece, I guess, stay in the union, because apparently Greece wasn't prepared to really go it alone at this point. The Germans basically said, and I guess the French, they kind of run the thing, a classic haircut, like writing down 40% of the debt, can't happen in a currency union. If they let Greece write down their debt, then what about Portugal? What about some of the others, of course? And Merkel even said, you can't have that in a currency union. The haircut's not possible. Now, what they might do is extend the maturity but not write down the debt. You know, in the meantime, you know, Greece is in the middle of a depression. The current government, which was supposed to, you know, lead them into some sort of favorable confrontation to the Eurozone, is not faring very well after, you know, these recent negotiations, and it's possible that there'll be some new elections and possibly a new government. But you know, Greece is only about 2% of GDP in the Eurozone, so you know its size is not the problem. The problem is the debt. Who's going to pay for it, and what impact all of this has on the European Union? And we read stories recently that you know, the Germans and the French are no longer agreeing on things the way they used to, and there are all sorts of strange and fractures going on within the Eurozone. And some of this has been in place for a while. Catalonia is the richest province in Spain. They pay most of the taxes. It's not clear that Spain would survive without Catalonia. And Catalonia is trying to have another referendum on a you know, a way to secede from Spain and form their own state. And, of course, the Spanish are not too anxious for that to happen. But, again, it's sort of emblematic of what's happening in the Eurozone and how fractious the, you know, entire Eurozone project has become. So, you know, none of this is particularly, you know, encouraging from a, you know, I guess a growth standpoint. And so I guess the Eurozone will continue to muddle along. But it looks like this Greece thing is going to be with us for a while. And unfortunately, it looks like there really is going to be no good solution, and that the, you know, the idea of Greece eventually leaving is probably still a pretty good bet.
Okay. I guess the other geopolitical event that really, you know, rose to the surface in the month of July was China. And, you know, China is not Greece. Greece is, as you mentioned, their economic impact is fairly minimal from a country perspective. Obviously, China is very important to the global growth engine. And, you know, they seem to have slowed dramatically. They've had quite a bit of volatility in the stock market this past month. After a huge run-up in stocks, you know, we saw a big sell-off, and then, you know, the government intervention manipulation is quite interesting. I guess that's what happens when you mix communism and capitalism. Talk to us a little bit about China and what the impact might be from their current situation.
Yeah, you mentioned manipulation and the fact that their, you know, their blend of capitalism and communism is certainly something that you know, no one has seen for a while. You know, they've been in the economic manipulation business now for a long time. You know, they've been pulling levers and turning dials and, you know, trying to you know, direct the economy this way and that way to do the best they can to improve the social situation and grow the economy and make sure they can provide jobs for, you know, millions of more people every year, you know, in, as far as I can tell, to, you know, maintain social order and keep the engine humming. But, I mean, obviously a centrally planned economy like that is going to have problems over time. And the real estate bubble appears to have burst. There are something like 70 million reported condos and dwellings around the country that are empty at this point. And real estate prices, you know, have begun to soften. Now, this may or may not have caused them to worry about their growth rate to the point where they thought we'll create a wealth effect and gin up the stock market, the internally, you know, stock market, which has been you know, doing nothing for a long time or not, but it appears that something caused them to begin to officially, in various party organs, to encourage people to invest in stocks and encourage people to buy stocks on margin. Well, obviously that created, you know, a tremendous boom in prices, you know, without any commensurate, you know, improvement in fundamentals to speak of. And as the prices continued to rise, they reached the point where the government thought that things might be getting out of hand, even though they generated the thing in the first place. And they began to step in and do things to, you know, control, you know, the market. But at that point, it had reached a bubble. and the bubble bursts, and you know, you don't know exactly how many people got caught up in this thing, but they're talking about millions and millions of people who borrowed a lot of money, and are now they're all underwater, I guess, like subprime housing in the U.S. That seems to be, you know, the story that is out there. And in the process of, you know, trying to deal with this, the bursting stock market bubble, if I'm counting correctly, I think there were three more measures they took today to try to stop the chaos. Add that to the 37 that one of our research sources listed the other day, and you've got about 40 measures or steps that have been taken in recent months to try to halt the carnage over there in stock prices. And you have to really wonder why they pumped up the market in the first place, and the desperation that has been evident in their desire to stabilize the thing suggests that they might be losing control of their economy relative to what they were able to do a few years ago. So it could be that China is facing, and given what we know about it, I mean, the growth rate has been slowing considerably, but, you know, the idea of a hard landing in China used to be poo-pooed a while back. Nobody's doing that anymore because it looks like they have probably lost the ability, to really manage the economy, and managing the economy like that would lead to problems anyway, but it looks like they might have lost that. And of course, as you mentioned, it's a big piece of the world economy. It impacts emerging markets. The emerging markets are feeling the effects of the slowdown in China. They're not importing as much as they used to. They're not exporting as much as they used to. So they are having an impact on world growth. And in fact, you look at car sales in China, whether it's European car sales or American car sales, they're weakening, and you're seeing less consumption and so forth and so on. So China is probably going to be a drag on world growth for a while, the hope is that it doesn't get completely out of control, but the authorities in China appear to be increasingly desperate to try to control the situation, and, it would appear that this, effort to pump up the stock market to try to improve consumption or something, has failed. So this is going to be an interesting experiment, I guess, to watch going forward. But at least for the near term, it looks like it's going to be a relatively, negative impact on world GDP.
Yeah, and just, for clarification purposes, it's a drag relative to where the growth rate has been previously. I mean, based on what I've seen, their economy is still growing, at least it's reported to still be growing. It's just going off a really probably unsustainable pace for much of the last 10 years to where it's still growing just at a much slower rate.
There's not really enough evidence out there to say that we're about to have a global recession of some sort. It's just that growth is going to be much lower than a lot of people anticipated a year or two back. And it's something that, I guess in a way it's affecting the entire, economic system, around the world. I mean, China's slowing. We haven't really slowed a lot. We're still at trend, but the trend's less than 2%. So that's not very exciting either. So, everything, particularly, China and Europe and the emerging markets have been much slower in the last 3 years. But again, it's not like we're about to fall off a cliff and, descend into a black hole, but it's disappointingly slow relative to what, had been expected a few years ago.
Sure. And the next topic is obviously related to the previous two, the effects on the economy on China and the Eurozone. It looks like really had an impact on commodity prices. And I think most of our listeners, if you watch the news or you drive down the street, you can tell that there's been another drop in the price of oil. But probably what a lot of listeners may not be aware of is that it's really not just oil. it's commodities in general, corn, copper, gold, lumber, you know, pick a commodity, and more than likely it was down in the month of July and probably down considerably. And, you know, the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, which is just a basket of different commodities, I believe is down 40% so far this year. So we've seen a really big drop in prices across the board. John, what does it mean? Is it something that we should be concerned about, or is it a good thing? How does that relate to the global economy?
Well, it's certainly a sign that, you know, global growth has been slowing for quite some time. If and we've talked about this, I think, on these calls before. If you go back to, you know, what happened after the great crash and the credit bust that, you know, was a worldwide event in, you know, 2008, early 2009, the response to that in the developing world was, of course, massive quantitative easing that, you know, started fairly early here and accelerated in Europe. The Chinese response was absolutely incredible. I mean, they spent more money. I mean, their version of QE, you know, put hours into the shade with the amount of debt they created, the amount of money they threw into their economy. I guess in anticipation of the recovery being as strong as it used to, and it used to be coming out of a recession, although there was a lot of data that suggested that might not be the case. I think there was a lot of belief that that might be the case. China ginned up their operations, whether it was, steel, concrete, you know, you name it. They borrowed a lot of money. They increased a lot of capacity. You know, borrowing to add to capacity around the world, and particularly in commodities, was absolutely enormous. That came to an end in 2012 when commodities peaked, and oil peaked a little bit later than the other commodities at about $114 a barrel, and you know, it was gradually coming down before the collapse. But in any case, commodity prices peaked several years ago, and they're still falling, and they reflect, you know, again, this overinvestment in productive capacity that simply, you know, overwhelmed demand over the last 3 years, and we're continuing to see that where the, you know, demand is relatively low, and there's just too much capacity too many things out there, I guess, that have been produced, and the price begins to fall. So, you know, it's kind of a reflection on what happened to, you know, the productive capacity around the world with the debt buildup, and, you know, what has happened since the, you know, economic growth rates didn't match, you know, what was added to productive capacity. And unfortunately, it looks like that process is not really it's not really over yet. The danger, I guess, in this decline in commodity prices is the deflationary impulse that it sends around the world. You know, all of these price declines put pressure on a lot of different areas of the economy. And, you know, for that reason, you know, inflation has not been a problem. And, you know, it's more of a deflationary problem now than inflation. And that's what the real worry is, that you get continued deflation, a continued decline in prices, and in the face of, you know, a fairly significant increase in dollar-denominated debt around the world, particularly in the emerging markets. So, you know, if that were to continue unchecked, then at some point, of course, deflation would gain a foothold and we'd have some real problems. But, you know, at this point, it doesn't look like we've reached that, you know, that level of concern, but you know, it certainly puts a lot of pressure on global growth, and you can see it in the leading indicators. The leading indicators, while still positive, are not as strong as they used to be, and you know, obviously our economy is not immune. If you look at our economic situation today, and you look at let's say the trend line since World War II, since 1945, and if you were to project growth in real GDP going forward from 2009 based on the trend established since 1945, you'd have an economy worth about $19 trillion today, but the current estimate's only $16 trillion, so we're 15% below trend, you know, following, you know, the bust. And in fact, we're not getting any closer to trend. If anything, we're sort of moving away from that, you know, that trend line drawn since 1945. And, you know, what's happened to us, in a sense, is kind of like what's happened to, you know, the rest of the global economy. It's just, you know, trend growth has moved in a direction that nobody really anticipated, I guess, and it's lasted for a very long time, and there's not much indication that that's necessarily going to change anytime soon. So I guess we're still in this low growth world, and you know, the hope is that the deflationary impulse that's created by the declining, you know, commodity prices is relatively you know, cyclical and not a secular you know, problem. You know, otherwise, I guess if it continues for a long period of time, then we got some issues. But you know, at the present time, it looks like it's being handled, but it's certainly depressive for world growth.
I guess, you know, the good news is that, you know, it seems like the U.S. economy, despite happenings around the globe, you know, continues to be resilient. You know, you could you know, listen to what's going on in the Eurozone, listen to what's going on in China, and, you know, there might be some concern that it really would negatively impact the U.S. economy. And as you mentioned, we're not growing at a tremendous rate, but we're growing. You know, and I think that's a really positive thing right now from an economic standpoint.
Yeah, the dollar is strong. I mean, that can, the strong dollar might have some impact on, you know, some other, you know, currencies and economies around the world. But at the present time, the strong dollar is you know, while it does, I guess, reduce corporate earnings that are earned overseas, you know, from an economic standpoint, it's not a bad thing to have right now.
All right, Jeff, let's switch gears a little bit. And, you know, in light of inflation being in check and a modestly growing economy, it looks more and more like it's full steam ahead for the Fed on their tightening program. I don't know if it's 50-50 on September versus December, but it looks like it's coming. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you're right on there. John's comments highlight some of the challenges that the Fed has in that, you know, there doesn't seem to be any runaway concerns regarding inflation or you know, wage growth, all the things that the Fed would normally look at. There aren't any real burning issues. Sort of in the back of the Fed's mind, though, is that the zero interest rate policy, which we've been in now for about 6 years, creates other issues in the markets, creates asset bubbles around. When you can borrow money at zero interest rates, then you'll go out and do sometimes crazy things, and it creates some issues outside of the traditional Fed list of concerns. So I think that's the reason why the Fed continues to look at raising rates. And if we just take Janet Yellen at her word, they're still looking hard, although the Fed met at the end of July and released their minutes, and there wasn't a big change from meetings past. They continue to kind of hint at something around between September and December. And you're right on. It's about a 50-50 coin flip right now as to whether it happens in September. My personal opinion, it probably doesn't happen in September for all the reasons that John was talking about. But it's still out there. It's still on the table. It's in the Fed has not done anything to indicate that September is not on the table. But what's really interesting is the market is really moving away from focusing now on whether it's September or December, but really when does the second rate increase take place? Because that's really more of that really has more impact on the financial markets because the question is how quickly will the Fed raise? Where will Fed funds rate be a year from now and 2 years from now? Those are the sorts of things that really will impact the psychology of the markets. And in general terms right now, because of all the things that John has talked about and you know from the Fed's perspective, the strong dollar is probably one of the biggest issues, even though they try not to talk about it. Raising rates makes the dollar even stronger. That makes it really difficult for folks like Caterpillar who try to sell their earth-moving equipment around the world. It's almost impossible to generate earnings growth in that kind of environment. So they're concerned about the stronger dollar in some respects. So they don't want to raise rates too much. But the general consensus is that the Fed probably raises rates maybe once a quarter over the next year and a half or so, maybe even 2 years, until they get to about 2% Fed funds rate. So that's, you know, from a historical perspective, that's not really a major tightening in the economy. That kind of just, I don't even know if that would even be qualify as getting us back to normal, frankly. It still would be a below market rate, I think, from a historical perspective. So whether they raise in September or December is becoming less important. What is important, though, is Janet Yellen's kind of low and slow approach to raising rates. Raise, start sooner and raise slower. Give the markets plenty time to react, and then also give them plenty time to assess the economic data as it comes out and be sure that they don't do anything to snuff out or at least slow down or retard the U.S. economy, because that is the thing that's kind of keeping the world going right now. So stay tuned, but low and slow seems to be the most likely path here, and probably sometime after December, which would make it more of a December raise, is most likely in my mind.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Morning, Greg.
Good morning.
Let's talk about stocks for a minute here. And good month for large cap stocks. S&P 500 was up 2.1%, but other sectors of the market didn't fare as well. The Russell 2000 was down 1.2% for the month, so pretty big spread between large cap and small cap. International stocks, if you look at the ACWI ex United States, down slightly, 0.3%. Also thought it was interesting, the Value Line Arithmetic Index, which is, you know, basically a way to look at the average stock, U.S. stocks, was down 1.5%. So pretty difficult month for the average stock. And then a little bit more detail in the large cap sector. As you might expect, based on our discussion about oil and commodities, energy stocks on the large cap space were down 12%, small cap energy stocks were down over 20%, so really difficult month there. A couple of the winning sectors, consumer discretionary, kind of a natural offset to energy, was up 12%. Healthcare was up a little bit over 12.6. So kind of an interesting month. Greg, give us a little more color around the month and then maybe analysis on where you think we're going from here.
Well, stocks are being pushed up by the fewest number in more than 15 years, which generally is not a good thing because it shows fatigue in a bull market. Something like 100% of this year's increase in the Standard & Poor's Index is attributable to two sectors, healthcare and retail. And that's kind of the tightest clustering we've seen in a long time. Brett, which is the number of stocks, as you pointed out, that are advancing, is really declined dramatically, which is not a good thing. We've gone something like, I think, 3 years without a 10% correction, so that really poses a lot of risk in the markets at this point. I think at this point, going forward, something like $17 trillion in value since 2009 when we had the rally, and shares are getting more and more expensive. They've been in, I think, 90% of the time in the past decade, and valuations of the winning stocks are even higher. And healthcare companies have led the bull market since the start of 2013, rising something like 87%, and that's pushed their P.E. ratios to 23.4. which is about 40% higher than their average since 2010. And if you look at PEs, I think it's going back to 1948, we're in the, something like the top highest second quintile. And again, you know, we talked about this before that, you know, we should have some kind of a correction, but we just don't get it. And it's been a long time. And so I think that's the big risk in the market still these days. So I think in terms of what the rest of the year holds for us, it's probably the implication, if you look at the historical returns, given our P.E. ratios right now of 18 to 20 times on the S&P, you know, a mid maybe low single-digit return. You know, we're coming off a pretty good year the last couple of years, but right now, unless there's some kind of a catalyst, it just seems like that we're going to have a very mediocre year in the stock market.
All right. Thank you, Greg. And Jeff, just maybe wrap up the call with a little discussion around interest rates. It looks like the 10-year for the month, you know, saw a pretty noticeable decline. We closed out June right around 235, 240, and then closed out July just below 220. So pretty decent move. And then in addition, I think we really need to at least touch on Puerto Rico as they are moving into default status. I think it's worth a brief discussion if you could.
Yeah, okay. I'll start with the bond market. And as you indicated, rates drifted a little lower because of the decline in commodity prices and certainly the instability in China around the world. We see some capital flows in, certainly into our treasury markets. So not a big move, but certainly there was an indication that the economy maybe wasn't rebounding quite as quickly as people had anticipated here in the U.S. And then, of course, around the world there continued to be some issues. So all that sort of conspired to take a little pressure off of the higher rates. And certainly, as I mentioned on the Fed front, it took a little bit out of the conviction that the Fed would raise in September, maybe it's later, all those things combined to push rates a little bit lower, but really more than anything just kind of a wobble in the trend that we've seen for the most part this year. Outside of just the Treasury markets, corporate spreads widened a little bit. Again, that reflects a little bit of the weakness in the economy. And then generally speaking, muni yields declined along with Treasury yields, such that it probably was about a 15 basis point decline on the 10-year, so roughly in line with the government, the U.S. government decline. So not much happening in terms of rates in the Treasury markets. As it relates to Puerto Rico, though, that was the big news. Certainly is the news that the municipal market has been looking at and waiting for. Puerto Rico finally tipped over into default status on they have a myriad of issues out there, and we won't get into the weeds on all that, but because of the amount of debt that they have, which is about $72 billion, some speculate it could be quite a bit higher than that, but generally speaking, the publicly recognized debt's about $72 billion. One of the smaller, more obscure issues that they have, the legislature actually elected not to allocate money to pay the debt, sort of forcing the issue in terms of default. Puerto Rico's different than Detroit for those that were keeping up with the muni markets in the last couple of years. Detroit basically went through the same thing. They were about $20 billion, so this is quite a bit larger, but it's this has been anticipated for a long time, so there have been some preparations there. Puerto Rico cannot declare bankruptcy, so all they can do is go into default and restructure. But they were hoping to get bankruptcy, the ability to file bankruptcy, and so far they have not been allowed to do that. That would take some kind of congressional intervention there. The feds will probably have to step in at some point because, Puerto Rico is $72 billion of municipal bonds is a big deal for investors, and that's mostly retail. So this really is just the opening salvo in what's, I'm sure, going to be a long and tortuous process of renegotiating the debt. I guess the good news in general is most of the debt at this point is held by hedge funds. So hedge funds, nobody has a lot of sympathy if hedge funds lose money. Probably not likely that they lose money. There'll be lots of lawsuits and things that that will take place over a course of many years. But there's going to be a lot more developments. But at this point, anyway, the process has finally begun, and we'll see where it takes us.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. We covered a lot of ground today. Thank you, everybody, for your contributions. And please join us next month. Our call will be on Tuesday, September 1st. Talk to you soon.